Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Hi there. Good morning. So today, what are we talking about? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Ceci here. Is anyone there? Hi, my name is Ceci. I'm based in Berlin, and I want to welcome you to CC, the podcast where you see what others see. In this season, we're talking about guts. And today, we'll talk about gut feeling, intuition, decision making, and how to gain insight and train cognitive skills. And guess with whom? We'll be talking.
Our guest today is Dr. Gary Klein, cognitive psychologist, senior scientist at Macro Cognition LLC, and founder of Shadowbox LLC, celebrated for his pioneering work in the field of naturalistic decision-making, NDM, or macrocognition, and for significantly influencing both academic research and practical applications in under-pressure decision-making in real-world environments. Over the course of at least four decades, Dr. Klein, one of the leaders of a team that redesigned the White House Situation Room, has been instrumental in enhancing the performance of various fields, including military, firefighting, healthcare, and aviation. Known in the world of science for developing several models of cognitive processes, such as the Recognition Prime Decision, RPD, model, the Data Frame model of sense-making, and the Triple Path model of insight, Dr. Klein is also the creator of multiple methods for training cognitive skills, such as the Critical Decision Method, the Pre-Mortem Method of Risk Assessment, and the Shadowbox Training Method. A PhD in experimental psychology by the University of Pittsburgh in the 1970s, he taught as an assistant professor in Oakland University and worked as a research psychologist for the Air Force Human Resources Laboratory. Dr. Klein is a fellow of both the American Psychological Association and the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society, and author of more than 150 publications, including numerous books such as Sources of Power, How People Make Decisions, The Power of Intuition, Working Minds, Streetlights and Shadows, Seeing What Others Don't, The Remarkable Way We Gain Insights, and his latest book, Snapshots of the Mind. In 2008, he received the Jack A. Kraft Innovator Award from the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society, HFES, the world's largest scientific association, founded in 1957 with the mission to advancing the science and practice of designing for people and systems through knowledge exchange, collaboration, and advocacy.
Dr. Gary Klein, a dream come true. Thank you for being here with us today, sir. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I would like to start today on board HMS Gloucester at the Desert Storm operation. It is 1990, and Michael Riley, a British naval officer, monitors the ship's radars. Suddenly, he sees something odd on his screen, and within a minute, he gives the order to shut what for many might have looked like a U.S. jet returning to the base. It turns out that Riley was right. He had made the right call, saving many lives, including his own. Dr. Klein, could you tell us more about the Naval Officer Riley's case and how his gut feeling and intuition helped him take a straightforward decision under conditions of enormous pressure?
Yes, this was, over 30 years ago during Operation Desert Storm. And Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, the United States, and its allies. There was a whole coalition pushing the Iraqi forces out of Kuwait. And Riley was a senior officer on the British HMS Gloucester. And they were off the coast of Kuwait. They were protecting an American battleship. And They knew that the Iraqis, they believed the Iraqis had a silkworm missile site someplace in Kuwait. They didn't know where, but a silkworm missile can do enormous damage, and they were worried about that. So they had been doing this for many days, and they were fairly exhausted. The shifts were 6 hours off. This was like hour five of their shift, so they were pretty tired, but that's when you let your guard down. And then all of a sudden, Riley sees a blip on his radar screen. And you have to understand that the American aircraft carriers were sending airplanes, I think they were A-6s, into Iraq to conduct missions. And the airplanes were coming back. So there was a constant stream of airplanes coming back from the Iraqi side. And you don't, a Navy officer, you don't want to see any kind of airplane flying overhead, but the Americans were eager to get back, and some of them were flying over the Gloucester, which made them uncomfortable, but they had to cope with that. And then all of a sudden, Riley sees a return, a blip on his radar screen, and he says, that's not an American fighter, that's a bomber, that's a silkworm missile. I've got 1 minute left before it reaches my ship and blows us up. He announces this, and everyone tries to figure out what to do. And they acquired that blip on other radars and that show that, suggest that it's a silkworm missile, and they shoot it down. But he wasn't sure. He wasn't sure that it wasn't an American plane and it had just killed the pilot. And so he and the captain of the Gloucester were nervously waiting until it was confirmed. Now the question, we interviewed Riley, and there was no way he could tell a silkworm missile apart from an American A-6. There was no way to distinguish the two on the radar screen he had. They were the same type of blip. They were flying at the same speed. They were the same size. And afterwards, British analysts, intelligence analysts, looked over the tape and said, there's no way he could tell, which pleased Riley because he thought he had extrasensory perception. And that's what had saved him. We were interviewing him to try to find out what we could learn, but we weren't analysts. And Riley had said what clued him in was that this blip was accelerating as it came off the coast. And we looked at the tape, about 10, 15 seconds of the tape, we had access to it. And we didn't see any acceleration from the first radar return to the second to the third. It was all the same. There wasn't any acceleration that we could find, nor could the intelligence analyst, which pleased Riley immensely. We were confirming that he had ESP. Now, there was one difference between a silkworm missile and the American airplanes. The airplanes were flying at 3,000 feet of altitude. The silkworm was usually operating at 1,500 feet, much closer to the ground. But the radar that Riley had didn't tell the altitude of the blip, so he didn't have that as a clue. So we were stumped, and Riley was delighted. And then one of our team, overnight, when we came back the next day, said, I think I figured it out. Yes, Riley couldn't tell what the altitude was, but on radar, it takes a while for a target for a missile or an airplane to break free of the ground clutter so you can pick it up over the water. If it's flying at a lower altitude, it takes longer for it to break out of the ground cover. And so compared to the A-6s, which you would see much closer to the coast because you could pick them up sooner, the silkworm missile, you couldn't pick it up until it was much further off the coast. And what it would look like to Riley was that it was accelerating when it came off the coast and then flying at the same speed. So Riley was wrong. He didn't have ESP. He was very unhappy when we told him this. He didn't have ESP. And he was wrong that it was not accelerating as it came off the coast. So if we hadn't listened to him, we wouldn't have solved the mystery. He perceived it as accelerating off the coast. That was the clue that allowed us to figure it out. That was his intuition. And he built that intuition from all of the weeks that he had spent watching his radar screen and knowing where the blips were likely to occur. So he sees this one much further out and it jarred him. There's something unusual about this, and that's what tipped him off.
Dr. Klein, have you come near, so to say, to rationally understand how insight comes about?
So insights are different from intuition. Intuition is how people use their experience to notice things, to size things up, to detect patterns, to detect anomalies, to see what's familiar, to see what's not familiar in this case, what's unusual. That's the way intuition works. Insights aren't relying on our use of our mental models and the patterns we've built up. Insights help us build richer mental models. And we have studied insights. I did a study of 120 examples of insights to examine exactly that question. Was there any pattern that I could pick up in these 120 examples? And I collected them from books and newspaper articles and just compiled them and went through them to see if there was one common theme running through all of them. And there wasn't. So that was frustrating. But I identified three different forms that insights can take. One of them is when we have different pieces of information that somehow, when you put them together, gives you a different idea. And that's the insight of putting pieces of information together that hadn't gone together before. We call that a connection insight. And that accounted for many of the cases and the body of examples we compiled. But there was another example where another set of cases where the insight occurred because there was a contradiction. These pieces don't fit together. And that was significant. I'll give you an example. A police officer told me this. He was riding with a newer officer who was only in his first year, and they're in traffic. I think this was in Los Angeles. And they are stopped at a light. They're just sitting there waiting for the light to turn. And the young officer looks at the car ahead, which is a brand new BMW. And he sees the driver take a drag on a cigarette and then flick the ashes, getting ready to continue driving. And the young officer says, "Who does that to a brand new BMW? Just flick the ashes. If you're the driver, or if you borrow it from somebody, you'd never do that. That's bizarre. Let's pull him over." So they pulled him over. Sure enough, it was a stolen car. So that's an example of a contradiction insight where the things don't fit together. And the third type of insight we found was one where you're being trapped by your assumptions. You're making some faulty assumptions. Sometimes we make these assumptions unconsciously, and we have to escape from these assumptions. And for that kind of insight, we found a number of those where people were able to escape from flawed beliefs. And what usually clued them all in was there was some hint. Something happened that was strange that made them look further, made them think further, and realize that they were looking at it all wrong. So those are three different pathways we've identified, three different ways that people form insights.
Very interesting. We'll go to that later in depth, but that gives us already a better picture of our theme today. And Dr. Klein, you're without a doubt an out-of-the-box thinker. So it did not surprise me at all that you wanted to jump out of the box, in this case, the lab, to go on and explore the field and observe how people make decisions in the real world. You started performing this kind of research in 1978 with your company, at that time called Research and Development. But it was not until 1989 that the naturalistic decision-making movement came into life. And this movement you pioneered drastically revolutionized the way cognitive research was performed regarding decision-making processes. It was a big leap from doing the research in controlled lab settings into taking this research, as we said, to real-world situations. But I want to ask you, how exactly did the natural decision-making movement was created, and which would you say are the most important tools it has provided us with up to the present day?
Okay, so we're very excited about the naturalistic decision-making framework. And as you pointed out, it's an attempt to understand how people make tough decisions and make sense of things in field conditions rather than under controlled laboratory environments. This movement, the first meeting that we had when the movement started was 1989, and we have conferences every 2 years. We're now planning for the 17th conference. So this is a source of great satisfaction. How did it get started? It got started in the mid-1980s with a program in the Army, the U.S. Army Research Institute. The Army had been very eager and motivated to find out, how do people make life and death decisions under extreme time pressure and uncertainty? And they used the best resources that were available, which was all the research that was coming out of laboratories. And that research really had not helped them. They had built decision aids based on that research. People didn't use them. And the decision aids didn't help. They developed training. The training wasn't particularly valuable or effective. So they wanted something else. So Judith Orosano at the Army Research Institute got permission to put together a program of non-traditional researchers, people who might have a different view than the ones coming out of academia and controlled environments. And she consulted with one of the leading decision researchers at the time, Ken Hammond, and they put together a set of about 6 or 7 different researchers that they thought might help them. I had just finished another project for the Army where I had come up with a model of real-world decision-making. It is called a recognition prime decision model. And I formed it based on research I had to figure out, how are we going to study real-world decision-making? And I could have studied it in a laboratory environment, but I figured everybody else is looking at a laboratory environment. And the fact is, the laboratory researchers were saying the only way to make a rational decision is to set out all your options and set up a set of evaluation criteria and evaluate each option on each criterion and see which one comes out. And other researchers showed that you can't even set this matrix up in less than a half hour. So how is a commander going to be able to use that kind of approach? That's why the laboratory-based approach wasn't very helpful. And I realized I didn't know the answer. So instead of trying to pretend I knew the answer, well, I had some idea, but I said, let's look at people who actually have to do it. So we studied firefighters because they have to make life and death decisions under extreme time pressure and uncertainty. And we had a 6-month project and we were successful in developing a model of how they actually were able to handle time pressure and uncertainty based on their experience, based on the years, in many cases, the decades of experience they had to be able to size situations up and see what was going on. So I had done that research, and that's why I was included in Judith Orosano's program. And this was the birth of the naturalistic decision-making community. And we decided to hold a conference in 1989 to invite these and other researchers to talk about what we knew about decision-making in the real world. The problem with studying decision-making in laboratories is it can't be life and death decisions. You can't have those kinds of consequences in a laboratory. You can't have organizational constraints. What they do in laboratories is they create artificial tasks for everybody to study. Well, people don't have that much experience with an artificial task. So they were missing the impact of experience that people like firefighters had or Michael Riley had. So that was the missing part of the equation. And that's why we were able to make some progress. What kinds of tools have been developed by naturalistic decision making? I could say one of the tools sort of is the models that we have of how people function under time pressure and uncertainty in these highly contextualized situations. Other kinds of tools, in order to do our research, we had to develop interviewing techniques. So this is another result from naturalistic decision making, to be able to do cognitive interviews like we did with Mike Riley. It took us 2 hours going over and over again this 10 or 15 second blip that we had from the records of the HMS Gloucester. So cognitive interviewing is one tool. Another one, once we did this, figured out how people make decisions, how do we train people? We have developed a technique called shadow box, and others have developed similar techniques using scenarios, putting people in scenario situations and probing them with decision points about what to do or what their goals might be or what kinds of information to gather, and then comparing that to what experts might do. I can talk about that more later. A third type of tool that we've developed is the identification of cognitive requirements. Right now, if you look at trying to understand how people perform a task, you look at their behaviors, but you're not necessarily looking at how they think. What's tough? What are the tough calls for them? What could confuse them? What are experts able to see that novices aren't? So these become the cognitive requirements of the task, and you can use that to design your training programs. And the fourth tool that I would mention is something we developed just a few years ago called AIQ, which is Artificial Intelligence Quotient, which is a tool to help people using artificial intelligence to understand their AI systems more effectively. And we can talk about that more later.
So we have, as you said, these three different pathways that reflect different types of forces that lead to the gaining of insight. And you talk about this in your book, Seeing What Others Don't, The Remarkable Ways We Gain Insight. In one of these pathways is the, in a way, very related to the patterns, into seeing when something doesn't fit and so on. And I want to ask you, in this process of recognizing patterns, is it here in the identifying of a missing part where intuition stands?
It's not that intuition starts with the patterns. Intuition is the use of patterns.
Okay.
And you have experiences, and then you sort of gel these experiences together. You kind of combine them to see overarching patterns. So you can say it's that type of a situation. It's this type of a situation. And when you do that, you have a sense of what's going on. You have a sense of what you should be looking at more carefully and what you don't have to pay as much attention to. You have a sense of what can I accomplish in this situation, the goals. You have a sense of what to expect. That's why experts are always smoother than the rest of us, because they know what's going to come next. But if your expectancy is violated, that tells you maybe I've misidentified the situation. And the patterns are telling you in this type of situation, here are the things that you can do. And so you have ready at hand options that you're prepared to put into play.
Mm-hmm. And thinking about the link between expertise and the recognition of patterns, I thought about a professional pianist who sees chord sequences in the music instead of single notes as piano players do with less expertise. Any change of pattern in a known chord sequence would be recognized in a fraction of a second by the pianist. The professional pianist would immediately know there is something wrong with the chord sequence. And this idea made me think about David Cantor, professor emeritus at the University of Liverpool for Applied Psychology, a highly regarded psychologist, developer of a discipline called investigative psychology, internationally known for introducing scientific psychology into offender profiling. Well, Professor Cantor uses the storage of information in a finely organized and utterly clear manner to create precisely these patterns of behavior, allowing authorities to anticipate the development of a criminal into an increasingly dangerous criminal, paving the pathway to his or her apprehension before him or her committing a more serious crime. According to these patterns, there is a very good example with burglars. There is a proof tendency that a burglar who breaks into a house and climbs over a balcony is likely to become a rapist later on in his criminal career. And if he is not stopped, he's likely to become a murderer and subsequently could become a serial killer. The idea behind the implementation of these patterns is to catch or arrest the criminal in an early stage development, as I said. Let's say before he starts climbing balconies at best. It seems to me that when looking for insight, Dr. Klein, it is not the decision taken by the expert what we're looking at, but rather the development that took the expert to take that decision. So regarding the gaining of insight, it is the whys of that decision and not the decision itself what really matters. Am I right on that, Dr. Klein?
Yes, I think you are.
Is this what you call recognition prime decision?
More or less. Now, I would like to say that when we studied the firefighters and in all of the professions we've studied since then, expertise is reflected through the pattern matching and the immediate recognition of what they think is going on in the situation. And because it's a pattern matching process, we don't know where our sense comes from. So it feels kind of magical, like to Michael Riley, it feels like extrasensory perception. He was pretty sure it was a silkworm missile, but he didn't know how he knew. And there didn't seem to be any rational explanation for it. So it seems a bit mystical, but it's not. It's just about pattern matching that is happening rapidly and often subconsciously. But that's not the only part of the story of the recognition prime decision model. Once you have an idea of what to do, then you have to assess, will it work in this situation? Because situations are unique. And there, what we found is people engage in mental simulation. They say, if I carry out this action that my intuition is telling me is likely to succeed, will it work here? And they play it through in their mind to see if it'll work. And if it will work, then they're ready, prepared to swing into action. If it will almost work, but there's problems, they try to adjust it. And if they can't see a good way to adjust it, then they say, what else can I do, until they find something that they think is workable. So it's a blend of this intuition, the pattern matching, and analysis. The mental simulation is done largely deliberately and consciously. So it isn't just intuition. It's intuition plus analysis.
And getting more into the subject of expertise, in the frame of the naturalistic decision-making model, along with Laura Militello and Rob Hutton, you developed an interview technique, and you were talking already about these interviews, called the knowledge audit, which focus is to distinguish experts from non-experts in a particular domain or task. Well, my question is, how does this interview work, and how do you identify an expert from a non-expert?
All right, two different questions. So the interview technique that we like the most is called a critical decision method. And it asks about tough cases, difficult cases that the person had to wrestle with, because we think that's where expertise comes out most clearly in the way people react to these tough cases. And these interviews take at least an hour, sometimes 2 hours, but they're very powerful. And we've made a lot of discoveries with them. And we identified different aspects of expertise, and then we just asked for examples of those aspects. So it really guides the person more. But now your second question, how do you know who's an expert? And the short answer is, you don't. There's no acid test for who is an expert. There's a variety of indicators, but none of them is perfect. So that's always something that you have to contend with. One of the ways that you suspect somebody is an expert is if they have a history of successful performance, but they may just have been lucky. Another way is these are the people that their colleagues turn to if there's something difficult going on. So their colleagues recognize them as having more expertise, but their colleagues may be mistaken. Their colleagues may just like talking to this person because the person looks wise, even though they're not all that skilled. A third is longevity. How many years has the person been doing the task? And that's a good indicator. that the person has compiled more experience. But just because you've compiled more experience doesn't mean it gets turned into expertise. And there are some people who have lots of experience, but never reflect on what they did and what they should have done. And they don't show the same progression. When I started my research with firefighters, I went to the chief of the fire department in the city where we were working, Dayton, Ohio. And I said, I want to talk to some of your best firefighters. And he said, do you want the ones who have the most experience or the ones who I think are the best? Because it's not the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I said, if it was your house on fire, who would you want to be on the scene? Those are the ones we want to talk about. So longevity is certainly a necessary condition, but not sufficient. A third is the credentials the person has. Have they been recognized? What kinds of training programs have they gone through? Another one is, can the person adapt? What we found is if there's an unusual case, journeymen get frustrated because they've got to figure out something else because their intuition isn't going to be enough. The experts get excited because now they're going to grapple with something that's challenging. My favorite criterion is about regret. I'll ask people, tell me about a situation where there was a decision that you regret, a mistake you made. You'd be surprised how many journeymen can't think of any mistakes that they've made. The experts have no problem telling you about their last mistake because that mistake has been eating at them. And they're trying to think about it and thinking, what should I have done differently? How should I have known? That's how they become experts, because they're learning from their failures and the journeymen aren't. They're repressing their failures.
Yeah, in my experience, I've noticed that the people that know the most about something, they're very aware that they're not flawless, you know? Whereas the people that doesn't know that much, as you said, they don't stop regarding the mistakes. They don't stop to see what the mistakes are or where they are.
Right,
so
exactly.
That's something that I've also noticed. And I've also noticed that, as you said, longevity is important. But of course, there's years that are more bumpy. So you need to be adaptable enough and flexible enough to make, I don't know, certain adjustments to go through it.
Let me just build on that point. It's not enough to put in the years. It's what kinds of challenges you're faced with, what kinds of tough cases come your way. That's why, say, physicians who are residents who want to work in emergency departments, they don't want to do their residency in quiet rural areas where there aren't that many cases. They want inner city neighborhoods where there's a constant stream of problems, lots of different problems. And that's a way that they're going to build their experience more rapidly by having to handle these challenges.
Exactly. And talking about experts, following, we will hear two experts in very different fields. Nicolas Pizarro, number one Latin American show jumping rider, and then Professor Thomas van Hulik, one of the best liver and pancreas researchers and surgeons worldwide, who will answer two questions formulated by you, Dr. Klein.
What is one of the toughest decisions you've had to make in your area of expertise? And what kinds of uncertainties did you have to wrestle with?
I guess the most important or the biggest quality of a rider is that you have to do adjustments. And to get this understood is that normally when we've isolized a course, we do like the big plan. And the difference between a normal rider or an exceptional rider is the one that is able and capable of doing an adjustment. So I would say that the biggest dare or the biggest threat you have during the ring is that you have to be strong mentally and physically. You have to be very fine to be able to do the adjustments. Most of the people won't do them at the moment because you didn't have them planned. And when you come out of the ring, when you come out of the course, you will discuss and you will understand and see, okay, here I had to do this, here I had to do this. Probably this I did too much, probably this I did too weak. But the difference that makes really a special writer is the ones that do the adjustments, the ones that do what is needed, the ones that give the horse in the moment, during the competition, during the course, that special aid that makes a big difference.
Well, firstly, an operation is never something you do automatically. Every operation is unique. There's no one operation which is the same as the other. But, of course, there are, let's say, the way you use your instruments, that can be automatic. The way you tie knots, the way you use your needle holder and sew, that is automatic. But there's no such thing as an automatic operation, even if you do it with a robot, because a robot is, of course, guided by a surgeon. Well, then still there are situations during an operation in which you see that the, let's say, the intended operation is not the operation you can do, because, for instance, there's a completely different conclusion when you started the operation. You can actually see the organs and you can see what the disease is. And that can be very difficult when it is a totally different, let's say, conclusion. When you see the organ and you see that it is not an inflammation, in fact, it is cancer, and very dramatically, that is metastasized to all the other, through the liver, but also lymph nodes and other things, then you know that this is a completely different diagnosis. And then it is very difficult what you have to do. So if you can't continue the operation in the same way you would have thought of, but you have to change the strategy, and even you might have to conclude that you can't do anything. You have to stop the operation, and then the problem comes that you have to tell the patient what the problem is.
Please give us an example of a tough judgment that you had to make recently.
Yes, of course. I think during the Global Champions Tour in Mexico with this edition, I did a change of a plan. I did an adjustment that it was good the first day. I did an extra stride to the last jump. And for sure, it took me more time to finish the course. But I knew that not doing this extra stride, probably I would have had the hold down. And then I learned, because in the Grand Prix, I didn't do the adjustment. I kept by the plan. When I had the feeling that the mare was a little bit tired and for sure needed a little bit of bounce or needed a little bit of getting her compacted for the last combination, but I kept by the plan. And I had those two poles down. So I really learned from it that I always have to follow my instinct. I always have to follow my gut feeling.
So the time I can remember that I had that much earlier was when I had contracted a very serious allergy to operation gloves. We know that that can happen, that as a surgeon you develop a kind of allergy to the operation gloves, and there are all kinds of, let's say, very pure synthetic gloves which don't have allergens in it, but still you can have very serious problems. And I had that in a very advanced extent, in which actually the skin was falling off my hands. And at that time I thought, well, maybe this is the end. I can't just go on with this problem. That was a struggle, because I thought, what will be next? But fortunately, it resolved. And so it passed, but it was a point in my life in which I thought, well, this is it. And I have to change my focus, and not so much on the operations, but on other aspects in surgery.
What I see here is what you were talking about, this adaptability and adjustments capability, this change of strategy. But I want to ask you, what is the most significant piece of information that we can identify in these answers regarding the recognition of patterns and the evaluation of expertise of our guests?
Right. You're very fortunate to have such knowledgeable and articulate experts that you were able to draw on. These are great examples. So let's start with the riding. I mean, both of them are saying the same thing, that you need to be able to adapt. So at least they're in sync with what we've been discussing.
Yes.
But I'm listening to these and wishing that there was a chance to probe further. So take the writing. I would like to see a diagram of the ring of the course to understand, for the first case where Pizarro added something to the routine, what did he add and what were the implications? And were there other options? And just how did he choose the additional part of his routine? So I'd be curious about that and how he made that choice. And then in the second example, when he gave the example of his mare getting tired, I never think about horses getting tired. I think about athletes getting tired. How did he know his horse was getting tired? What clues was he picking up? I mean, he's such an experienced rider. So he's noticing something about his mare. Can he give some? I wouldn't ask, did you make the judgment? I would ask, tell me what you were noticing. What were you feeling? Was it the sound of the mare's breathing? Was it, don't even know what options to consider, but I would ask what he was picking up on to try to get at the seed of his expertise there. For the surgeon, that's one of the things that makes surgery so exciting is you don't know what you're up against. And it's not a mechanical procedure. It's seeing what's going on inside this patient. And how do we have to adapt to it? And I imagine that there are tough cases where he had to judge, do I continue with this operation or do I decide that the cancer has spread too far? What's he looking at to make that kind of, how has he made that kind of discrimination? What kinds of clues let him decide to press on or not to? I would have been curious to get examples where he pressed on or did not press on, and see what differentiated that. With regard to the gloves, I wonder if there were any workarounds. There were other kinds of gloves he could have used and that might not have caused his allergic reaction. And what were their strengths and weaknesses? So I think that there was something more to be learned. He described his frustration, but I'm guessing he made some sort of adaptation in his own preparation, his own surgical preparation. And maybe he used other kinds of gloves in less critical situations so that the allergy wasn't as strong. I'm just speculating, but that's where I would have liked to question further.
We were mentioning also that the experts know not only the mistakes, but also their limits. And I think that's a very important sign of expertise in this case.
Yeah, I would have wondered, let's say he did take some time off. He said, I'm going to spend more time teaching until the allergy clears up and then go back to surgery. Would that have been feasible or would that have been risky to continue his surgical career after taking a year or two off? Maybe his skills might have eroded in that time.
Yeah, and you were mentioning show jumping rider Nicolas Pizarro. I think it is important that he mentioned these adjustments he was able to do. And what you were saying about the horse and knowing his horse, and that made me think also again about what we were saying, that it's actually about the whys. Why did he had that thought? What made him make this decision? And not only the adjustment itself, but what was the vision at the moment that said, okay, here, you need to make an adjustment?
Right. Now, we've learned not to ask people why, even though that's what we're desperately interested in finding out, because it's difficult for experts to explain why. Michael Riley could not explain why he thought it was a silkworm missile. So instead, we ask, what were you noticing? What were you picking up on?
Mm-hmm.
So for Nicolas Pizarro, he judged that he needed to do more. He judged somehow that his routine was not going as successfully as he needed it to be. What were the indicators? What had happened during his routine that made him uneasy, that made him realize that he needed to adjust what his original plan was?
We come to the end of the first of the two parts of this episode. Thank you, Dr. Klein.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And next time, we will continue to talk about gut feeling, intuition, decision-making, and how to gain insight and train cognitive skills. Thank you, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Hi, we would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button.